With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, the USDA expands insurance options for nursery growers. But our top story today, farmers and ranchers in the Texas Panhandle and parts of Oklahoma have lost hundreds of thousands of dollars from the wildfires. And while the outpouring of support has been tremendous, Texas Governor Greg Abbott says they will continue to need help.
There's a lot of cattle in the entire region that have no food. And again, there has been a big outpouring of support. But the hay that has been delivered has already been used for the most part. And the reality is for not just days, but for months, there's going to be far more hay that is needed. I'm very proud and grateful for our fellow Texans stepping up and helping out, as well as other states that are willing to provide assistance, and farmers and ranchers and donors and supporters across America. But I just want all of them and all of you all to know that there is much more hay that's going to be needed for all the livestock across the entire region. And the more and the quicker that you can provide it, all the better.
He says they also need fencing materials and cattle cubes, but he's asking those who want to help to reach out to see exactly what is needed.
We don't want a lot of people just funneling in whatever fencing material they may have, because there are certain specifications that have to be met in order to have the type and quality of fencing that's needed for the ranches in this area.
The Texas AgriLife Extension is recommending higher protein cubes or cakes from something like a 28% distiller grain to 38% cottonseed meal-based cubes, saying it will be best suited to help fill the protein and energy voids left by relatively low-quality hay. Meanwhile, USDA is helping producers affected by those catastrophic wildfires.
We will do everything we can to support farmers, ranchers, and impacted communities on the long road to recovery. Those words from Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in reaction to the devastating wildfires that have burned at least 1.3 million acres in the Texas Panhandle and western Oklahoma, destroying homes, farms, pastures, and livestock. Vilsack has directed the USDA to help in the recovery efforts. USDA already has 200 people on the ground helping with fire suppression and has people from USDA's Farm Service Agency and Natural Resources Conservation Service holding informational sessions outlining for producers the many programs that are available in the disaster situation such as this. Everything from emergency loans to programs to help producers who have dead animals to dispose of. Secretary Vilsack said full recovery from this disaster will likely take many months, and USDA will be there for however long it takes. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
The Securities and Exchange Commission recently released its final emissions reporting rule without Scope 3 requirements. Chad Smith has more.
The SEC's final climate disclosure rule doesn't contain Scope 3, which would have seriously burdened U.S. farmers and ranchers. Travis Cushman, Deputy General Counsel for Litigation and Public Policy with the American Farm Bureau, says the final rule is notable for what it does not include.
What it does not look like is the way the proposal was 2 years ago, which would have included Scope 3. Scope 3 would have required public companies report on the greenhouse gas emissions of their supply chain, meaning that farmers would potentially have to be tracking all their emissions constantly. And anytime you sell a bushel of corn, you'd have to say these are how much of seven different types of greenhouse gases were emitted for every bushel I am selling.
The final rule means Scope 3 is off the table for now everywhere except California.
This is a final rule. 2 years ago, the Securities and Exchange Commission put out their proposal, which included Scope 3, and this final rule has fully eliminated it, which we are incredibly excited and thankful for. In terms of what comes next, California recently passed a rule that would also require the disclosure of Scope 3 for anyone doing business in California. We also have sued California over this as well.
The Scope 3 victory is a result of hard work done by both the Farm Bureau and its grassroots members across the country.
This is an example of how well Farm Bureau works when it works together. It's advocacy, it's grassroots. We had our members send 20,000 messages, SEC and Capitol Hill, explaining to them how this could really hurt them. All those things together helped create this result.
For more information, go to fb.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
The presidential State of the Union address Thursday included mentions of various USDA's efforts ranging from high-speed internet to conservation. Here's Rod Bain.
Some presidential mention with USDA connection. Among the items discussed by President Joe Biden at his State of the Union address Thursday.
Modernize our roads and bridges, ports and airports, public transit systems.
With one example, USDA's Commodity Container Assistance Program.
Affordable high-speed internet, no matter where you live.
Through efforts such as the Reconnect Program.
Record investments in tribal communities.
Such as USDA programs supporting development of small and mid-sized meat and processing facilities in tribal nations.
Conserving 30% of America's lands and waters by 2030.
As USDA conservation and climate smart programs are among chief facilitators of these efforts. The president also recognized Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack in his address.
And finally, it's what was led by my Secretary of Agriculture, who knows more about this than anybody I know. We're better able to stay in the family, those farms, so the children and grandchildren won't have to leave.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, a new and easier way to pasteurize eggs could help make it more common in the industry. David Geiger has this report.
Radio frequencies may be a better way to make eggs safer. Salmonella bacteria is a concern for the food industry. The Center for Disease Control reports an annual 1.3 million infections, 26,000 hospitalizations, and 420 deaths in the United States. Eggs are often a repeat offender, but egg pasteurization has a time and labor-intensive process. That's why researchers with USDA's Agricultural Research Service wanted to find another sterilization method. Research food technologist Dr. Daniela Bermudez says the established way of pasteurizing eggs through water is not often used.
Only 3% of the eggs are sold pasteurized because it takes a lot of time, it can damage the quality of the eggs, and you need to pay extra price for pasteurized eggs.
And because the ARS team noticed a lot of cases of salmonella in eggs, they searched for a faster way to pasteurize.
So when you are using water to pasteurize eggs, you usually are about 56.7 degrees Celsius. If you are start increasing the temperature, let's say you are reaching like 60 or beyond 60, you are going to damage the quality of the egg.
The team found radio frequency technology, using its energy to warm temperatures to those pasteurization levels. Without cooking the egg, of course, Bermudez says it's similar to a microwave.
The main difference is the working frequency. In radio frequency, we are using, let's say, lower frequencies compared to the microwave technology.
The principle, however, is the same as they aim at the water inside of the egg.
These water molecules start to rotate when you are starting the application of the electric field. It could be the microwave, it could be the radio frequency. So what happens with the water molecules inside? They start to rotate. They are trying to align to the electric field that you are providing with the microwave or the radio frequency. And when they start rotating, you're generating friction. So this friction is going to warm up the egg.
And because the heat comes from within, it's applied more evenly and efficiently, going directly to the yolk. Standard pasteurization dunks eggs in warm water for a full hour. Radio technology takes two-fifths of the time. Bermudez says it's come a long way in 10 years.
We were using one egg, and we were passing electricity in one single egg. And it has been evolving, the unit that we have.
Now they're working with the fifth generation of pasteurizing technology. Bermudez says with the billions of eggs produced every year, the saved time makes their invention more viable. It has a capacity now of 24 eggs.
You may be like, well, that is not going to work. The unit that we have has been designed to be replicated as needed. So if you want to process 1,000 eggs per hour, that will be possible to do it because it's just like adding blocks. Our design is very, very standard, and we can add as many blocks as needed. And we're planning to have like a semi-continuous process.
Testing radio frequencies at scale means the ARS needs partners.
We are working with a local farm. They are processing more than a million of eggs every day. So our unit is expected to be processing many eggs at a time. 24.5 minutes is still something that we can do for billions of eggs.
They are still trying to reduce the pasteurization time to under 20 minutes. The Agricultural Research Service is always looking for collaboration. Bermudez says you can email her or contact the ARS for more details. I'm David Geiger reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with this livestock report.
In today's livestock news, the Dairy Checkoff will showcase dairy innovation and its overall nutrition package to more than 70,000 people attending the country's leading trade show in the natural, organic, and healthy products industry. A Dairy Management Incorporated team will be on site at the Natural Products Expo West event March 12th through the 16th in Anaheim, California, with the goal of spurring dairy innovation among entrepreneurs, investors, and others seeking to grow their food and beverage business. This will be the Checkoff's first time at the event. "We want dairy to show up and show up in a big way," said Marla Burke, Executive Vice President of Innovation for DMI. "It typically is the non-dairy alternative companies at this event, but this is the biggest natural food show, and we're the biggest natural food besides vegetables." She continued by saying, "It just makes sense to be there to feature all the great innovation that's happening in dairy and the nutrient package we bring to the table." Among DMI's goals at Expo West is to share a new Checkoff-created tool designed to help entrepreneurs. www.innovatewithdairy.com. This tool serves as a one-stop shop for anyone seeking information about the dairy innovation process, from concept and product development, and all the way through launching into market. Users will have access to more than 250 vetted dairy resources, including many leading researchers and professors who comprise the Dairy Food Research Center's network. The Checkoff created the network more than 35 years ago to provide science-backed solutions related to processing, technology solutions, food quality and safety, ingredients, and other areas. DMI will also feature innovative dairy products at its booth to inspire attendees of what is possible with dairy. Finally, DMI will lead an education session to share insight from a Checkoff-led study of 12,000 U.S. consumers. The result found more than 50% of participants are dissatisfied with U.S. food and beverages they consume for health and wellness needs. There's widespread discontent in the $350 billion health and wellness category, and this opens a huge door for dairy, Burke says. "We understand why these consumers are dissatisfied, and we hope to show entrepreneurs the many opportunities that exist where they can innovate with dairy to meet these needs." To learn more about the Dairy Checkoff, visit usdairy.com. In other livestock news, the California Department of Food and Agriculture's Dairy Plus program rolled out earlier this year. The program will award competitive grants to California dairy farms for the implementation of advanced manure management practices that reduce both methane emissions and nutrient surplus. The California Dairy Research Foundation, in collaboration with CDFA and several other organizations, was awarded $85 million in funding by the U.S. Department of Agriculture under the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program in 2022. Their plan over the next 5 years is to provide incentives to producers who adopt advanced climate smart manure management practices, along with the outreach and technical assistance, measure greenhouse gases and nitrogen benefits associated with implemented practices, and develop markets for climate smart commodities. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The Department of Water Resources has completed its mapping project in all high and medium priority groundwater basins in California. The statewide airborne electromagnetic survey project has encompassed helicopter-based technology to scan subsurface depths of up to 1,000 feet, providing critical information about underground aquifers. This data, now publicly accessible, will be used to help with the identification of locations for groundwater recharge projects. AEM data will reportedly facilitate expedited project development to ensure that resources are allocated efficiently. DWR's ongoing efforts, including basin characterization, aim to enhance understanding and management of groundwater basins. Innovative tools like the online AEM data viewers enable broad access to complex geologic data, fostering collaboration and informed decision-making. The Federal Trade Commission has filed a lawsuit to block Kroger Company's nearly $25 billion acquisition of Albertsons Companies, alleging anti-competitive practices. The merger, if allowed, would create the largest supermarket entity in the U.S., raising concerns about increased grocery prices, diminished product quality, and fewer choices for consumers. The FTC contends that the proposed divestitures to C&S wholesale grocers are inadequate and fail to mitigate lost competition. Moreover, the merger threatens grocery workers' wages, benefits, and working conditions, as Kroger and Albertsons are major employers of union labor. Attorneys general from 8 states and the District of Columbia have also joined the FTC's lawsuit. The action taken against the merger reflects broader concerns about market concentration and consumer welfare, particularly as food prices continue to rise. The USDA is expanding its Nursery Value Select crop insurance program to cover nursery producers in all counties across all states. NVS allows producers to choose coverage amounts tailored to their risk management needs and provides improved coverage compared to the nursery field-grown and container program. The expansion aims to offer insurance options for a broader group of producers, including specialty crop producers. NVS, which covers field-grown and containerized nursery plants, will now be available nationwide beginning with the 2025 crop year. Previously, NVS was only available in select counties across 9 states. First available in the 2021 crop year, producers insured over $460 million in liability through the NVS in the 2023 crop year. The USDA's Risk Management Agency views the expansion as meeting a critical need for American nursery producers. The dairy margin coverage enrollment period is now open. Farm Service Agency Administrator Zach Ducheneau highlighted the value of the program and the online decision tool they have available for producers at dmc.dairymarkets.org.
Dairy margin coverage helps producers with assistance when the price of milk and the cost of feed fall below a certain level. And there's a really handy tool on our website that can help producers identify what the best level of coverage is. It's a really affordable risk management tool. And based on what we saw last year as we were coming up to the normal enrollment period, some producers were looking at it and maybe not seeing the value in it. And those that did actually reaped the benefit for a good part of 2023. So we really hope producers take a look at this valuable tool and take advantage of the opportunity to have an affordable risk management strategy at their disposal.
California Agriculture Day at the state capitol is coming up on Tuesday, March 19th. California Ag Day is part of the National Agriculture Day campaign to recognize and celebrate the abundance provided by agriculture. Hosted by the California Department of Food and Agriculture, the California Foundation for Agriculture in the Classroom, and California Women for Agriculture, California Ag Day is an annual celebration recognizing the state's agricultural community by showcasing the bounty of crops and commodities produced in California. It's also an opportunity for farmers and agribusinesses to engage with state legislators, government leaders, and the public for agricultural education. The theme for Ag Day this year is Next Gen Tools, Talent, and Tech. The festivities will be open to the public beginning at 11:30 on the west steps of the state capitol in Sacramento. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Winter wheat is improving in some parts of the nation. Here's Rod Bain.
What does winter wheat crop conditions look like as a whole among states reporting to USDA this time of year? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says within the end of February edition of the Agriculture Department State Stories report,
the good news for winter wheat is that we have had a relatively easy winter. The crop, generally speaking, has seen improved moisture since planting. And other than a cold outbreak that hit in mid-January, we have escaped significant weather challenges that could have hurt the crop.
Yet, what does that mean on a state level?
Conditions in our number one production state improving. Kansas, which went into this winter, which is 32% of the winter wheat rated in good to excellent condition, has seen improvements each month and now coming in at 57% good to excellent. At the same time, Kansas wheat rated very poor to poor was 32% near the end of November. That has since dropped to 13%.
Rippey adds similar condition trend improvements are noted for winter wheat throughout the winter in the Great Plains and Midwest.
We have a long list of states where the winter wheat is rated at least two-thirds good to excellent. Just going alphabetically through those, we have California, as well as Indiana, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, all making that list of at least two-thirds good to excellent.
Meanwhile,
we only have two of our reporting states with double digits in the very poor-to-poor categories as of February 25th. That is Kansas at 13%. The other state in double digits at this time is Texas, 19% very poor to poor.
So Rippey summarizes the winter wheat crop outlook via reporting states in the February State Stories edition.
A pretty optimistic look at the winter wheat situation as we head into spring, with only about one-eighth of the U.S. production area currently experiencing drought, down from nearly half of the crop at planting.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The difference between rural and urban is growing when it comes to disease mortality. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Over the last two decades, disease-related mortality rates have widened between rural and urban areas, especially for the prime working-age population, which is age 25 to 54. Researchers with the USDA compared natural cause mortality in rural and urban areas between 2 3-year periods of 1999 to 2001 and 2017 through 2019. They found the gap between rural and urban natural cause mortality rates widened between the two time periods. Natural cause mortality rates decreased across all age groups in urban areas. In rural areas, mortality rates decreased for most age groups, although not as much as the same groups in urban areas. However, they did increase for the prime working age population. Increased mortality rates for people who are of prime working age are an indicator of worse population health. For this segment, we go back to Commodity Classic, held in Houston, Texas, earlier this month. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and I'm talking with the Executive Director of National Sorghum Producers, Greg Rulli.
So tell me, what are some of the key things going on with sorghum?
A ton of things. You know, like many of the commodity groups, Farm Bill is a big priority for all of the farm groups, just to make sure we get that stability and that certainty in farm policy. So we're continuing to press for Farm Bill passage this year. We know the calendar is short, and it'll be a challenge to get that adopted. But good progress made this week on the continuing resolutions, and those are the things that are kind of standing in the way of moving farm legislation. So moving the continuing resolutions out far enough to negotiate and finalize FY24 appropriations measures is the first step in the process. We'll follow along then with committee debate and discussion, moving out of chairman's mark on the farm bill. I think the House Ag Committee will lead in that process, and then our hopes would be to bring the Senate along and move legislation. You know, everybody worries about election year, and they think that things end when we have an election on the first Tuesday after the first Monday of November. That's hardly the case. We could certainly see activity in late November and December in a lame duck session that would allow us to finalize legislation then.
So what are some of the key programs in the Farm Bill for sorghum producers?
It's a really simple message for us, and that is there's got to be more farm in the Farm Bill. We've got to have a safety net that recognizes the decline in commodity prices that we're seeing right now, that recognizes the increased risk that we have from a smaller margin in commodity agriculture. And you know, sorghum's no different than any other commodity in that space. So making sure the safety net is adequate to cover the needs that we have in this particular market is a critical importance. There's a lot of components to that. Making sure we have a vibrant crop insurance program. Making sure that reference prices are reflective of cost of production. Those are things that, you know, policies shared broadly across the commodity organizations and are critical. You know, beyond that, we have really begun to develop an aggressive opportunity or an aggressive role in the sustainability space. Sorghum's got a great story to tell, one that the other commodities really have to kind of follow along behind us. But you know, we're a resource-conserving crop. We're the crop that farmers grow when you're in that position where you don't get enough rainfall, or you have irrigation restrictions in place that reduce your opportunities for applying water throughout the growing season. Sorghum's a crop that they go to, and so that's an opportunity that plays well among consumers today, both in the food space as well as the feed space, whether we're producing sorghum silage for dairy or beef cattle, or sorghum as an ingredient in pet food. There's some really good opportunities there for sorghum to establish its rightful place in that sustainability space.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned the water and sorghum. How is sorghum doing as a crop in California with all of their water restrictions and their drought troubles, which this year has been a little bit different because of all the rain?
What an interesting turn of events for California, right? Going from drought to extreme drought conditions, and then now suddenly, you know, anything but drought, just overwhelmed with water in significant quantities in short periods of time. You know, really, it really creates some challenges. Sorghum's role, you know, in California, I think continues to grow, maybe for a different set of reasons. I think part of that is its ability to fill that export market niche, the location, the transit, your cost of shipping become very advantageous. Sorghum's role in biofuels production will also create an opportunity, I think, for more acres to be grown in California. It's one of those growing markets where, and it's, you know, California has such a diverse agricultural system. A lot of people are vying for those acres that exist. And you know, when it comes to a water argument, sustainability argument, clearly we think sorghum's got the story to tell that few others can bring to the table.
Right. Well, let's talk about the entire nation now, and you talked a bit about crop insurance.
Yeah.
The importance of that in the Farm Bill. Would you like to see additional programs?
Yeah, you know, there's a pretty significant push to move away from the ad hoc disaster payments that happen and take those dollars and use it to strengthen the safety net, we think that's really good public policy. None of us want to operate by ad hoc disaster programs year after year. And if you look at the spending charts, it's crazy the amount of off-budget spending that is represented by those ad hoc disaster programs. So realigning the safety net to be that true safety net and to operate as it should and to provide that assurance to the farmer and to the consumer about a safe and affordable food supply is critical. It's going to be a process, though. Yeah, there are a lot of demands for any pool of money that one might find available out there. And so the commodity groups right now are united, I believe, in pushing for, you know, those sorts of reforms to the farm safety net.
All right. Is there anything else that you think is important for our listeners to hear?
I think the one thing I would add is sorghum was very fortunate to be one of the awardees of a Climate Smart grant. That program, we've got the first year, a pilot year, under our belt. We had 23 farmers on about 10,000 acres who were helping us gather the data necessary to make those Climate Smart claims. This program grows for us exponentially over the next 5 years.
Thank you again to Greg Ruling, Executive Director of National Sorghum Producers. This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Here's Chuck Zimmerman with today's featured interview.
I'm visiting with Amber Lusink with TruTerra. And first of all, Amber, tell us what you do.
Hi. Yes. So I work for TruTerra. TruTerra is a subsidiary of Land O'Lakes. And so we are the sustainability arm of Land O'Lakes. And so at TruTerra, I get to execute our Climate Smart grant. So Climate Smart is becoming a more common phrase in the ag space and specifically with farmers. And so TruTerra was a recipient of one of the Climate Smart grants from USDA. And so now we are executing on those opportunities.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about, you know, this financial assistance program. Tell me, how does it work? What's it for? How does it use?
The financial assistance program is one of our first programs that we're able to roll out under the Climate Smart funding. And it's super exciting because it's really what TruTerra is founded on is meeting the farmer where they're at in their sustainable journey. And so whether that means, you know, a farmer is just now trying things out and they want to try things, but trying cover crop or reducing your tillage to strip till or no-till, that can be scary. And so we want to work with the farmer and provide that technical assistance. But now we're also able to offer financial assistance. So while we can't completely mitigate all of the risk for the farmer, we want to work with them. We want to walk with them and then provide that financial assistance to reduce that burden and honestly, you know, reduce that barrier for the farmers to try these new sustainable practices.
Since this started, last year, how has that been going?
It's gone really well. And like with everything, you know, when you're trying something new, you want to start small. And that's what we've encouraged with this program. And that's how we've executed this program. So we launched a pilot in 2023. And we have 15,000 acres that are currently enrolled and going through that program. And so we wanted to make sure we were doing the best thing for the farmers. And, you know, if we needed to make tweaks along the way for the program to make sure it's, you know, the best thing for the farmer, that's what we wanted to do. And so we're executing on 15,000 acres right now. And then we will be launching the remainder of our funding opportunity in August. And so that's a key date for farmers out there is just to really look forward to August and we'll have some of these programs rolling out.
With your program, how does TruTerra stand out or be the one that they choose?
That's what I get excited about is, you know, why TruTerra? You know, TruTerra is, like I said, a subsidiary of Land O'Lakes. And so that's something that is just really foundational to, you know, kind of our beliefs and our mission in terms of, you know, working with farmers. We work for the farmer. I work at TruTerra, so I get a peek behind that curtain. I understand, you know, on our commercial side, you know, all of the different carbon programs that are out there. And I feel good about them. You know, I truly know that we do work for the farmer. And so that's what's exciting about these programs. And what really makes TruTerra stand out as well is, you know, our like trusted advisors across the country. So we work with our ag retail network. We understand that cooperative system. And so we work with our trusted advisors. And those advisors can work really one-on-one with those farmers. And, you know, whether it's holding their hand or giving them encouragement, giving them recommendations, that's what sets us apart. There's a lot of different Climate Smart opportunities out there. And I want all farmers to, you know, engage. And if TruTerra's Climate Smart opportunity through the financial assistance program is what works best for that farmer, you know, we'd love to work with them.
Well, you mentioned how many acres, I guess, you have enrolled now, but what's your, like, hope or expectation, say, maybe in the next year?
Yeah, so, you know, we're really looking forward, you know, there's a couple different opportunities. So we've been talking about financial assistance, and we'll be looking at roughly 80,000 acres of financial assistance opportunity for farmers. And so that's a pretty considerable acreage funding available. Another funding opportunity that's really exciting is our early adopter. So those early adopters are those farmers that have been doing the right thing, right? They've been those long-term no-till, and until recently, there haven't been opportunities for those farmers, and you know, both commercial programs. But then we have this Climate Smart funding, right? So we finally are able to, you know, reward those long-term adopters for quote-unquote doing the right thing all the time. And so that's another really exciting program that we're going to be launching. We're going to be launching that first round here in the summer. We'll be launching it regionally, but overall, we're looking at 800,000 acres that we will be working with for our early adopter program. And so those are two of the really exciting things. And what that means is getting you know, this Climate Smart funding straight into the hands of farmers to either incentivize them, reduce that risk for that financial assistance, or reward them for doing the sustainable farming practices, you know, all this time.
What's the number one thing that they use the financial assistance for?
Yeah, so the financial assistance is directly for, you know, either reducing tillage to strip till or going straight down to no-till, or planting a cover crop. And so the program is tiered based on that. So, you know, there's different payment structures for that based on if you're no-till or strip till, or if you're planting cover crop, or if you're doing both. So that's how the program works. And so, you know, that funding is really to offset the costs for that farmer.
So if a farmer wants to, how do they apply for the program?
So that's one thing with Truterra we've worked really hard over the past few years is to try to make it really farmer friendly. We understand enrolling in programs can be cumbersome. The data piece is cumbersome. That's a big hot topic, and that's something that Truterra is really dedicated on. So honestly, going straight to truterraag.com, that's a great landing point. You can go ahead and get into, we call it My Portal. And so that is a one-stop shop for farmers to be able to create an account. It's very simple. You can do it in about a minute. And then you can go in and you can upload your boundaries or draw your boundaries, fill out some very basic practice information, and then you can see opportunities that are available. And then also understand, you know, there's going to be more opportunities launching in the summer. And so the benefit sometimes now is, you know, maybe in some downtime for farmers, they can go in and get their fields uploaded and get that information in there. And so then once the programs are available, they can see what opportunities they qualify for and really take advantage of them.
So before we close, is there anything else you would like growers, customers to know that we didn't touch on?
Yeah, I obviously work for Truterra, so I could be biased, but I really am very pleased with the programming that Truterra has come out with. I know it's a competitive market. I'm married to a farmer, and I'm, you know, he's also an agronomist, and so I see the confusion in the marketplace. I see there's so many different programs out there, and I can understand why it can be, you know, hard for farmers to really, you know, disseminate through all of that information, and so that's what I'm passionate about.
Thank you very much for taking a few minutes to visit here. We're at Commodity Classic. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. Now for more news. Reports of cyber attacks, ransomware, hacking, and electronic fraud have become almost commonplace in the United States and Canada. Dennis Guy reports.
According to Statistics Canada, about 20% of all businesses can expect to be hit by a cybersecurity hack at some point. Now it seems that farm operations might be attracting the interest of hackers because fraudsters see farm operations as potentially lucrative targets, often with outdated fraud protection tools in place. According to a 2021 study at the University of Guelph in Ontario, cyber attacks are on the rise as farmers adopt more internet-based technology for use in daily operations. About a year ago, the Ontario Federation of Agriculture implemented an ongoing series of live town hall and Zoom-style meetings for their 38,000 members, hosting speakers who specialize in cybercrime prevention. Kathy Lennon, general manager of the Ontario Federation of Agriculture, based in Guelph, has been hosting many of these meetings. Lennon says that every single point along the agri-food chain has been hit by a cyber attack because today nearly every business is connected to the internet somehow.
I think everyone is equally at risk. We've seen it on the farm, in the processing plants, and at retail. If you have a cell phone, if you have a computer, an iPad, if you have items on the farm that are connected to the internet, you are a target.
Kathy Lennon says there is a misconception that computer system hackers are looking to extort only the bigger commercial businesses for large amounts of money. One particular case stands out for her. An unusual extortion attempt that did not involve money was made on a fairly small farm operation in Ontario just last year.
Fairly simple ransomware was used to break into a small Ontario hog farm. They were able to paralyze cameras, accounting systems, feeding systems. The farm was held at a standstill for a number of weeks. The attacker did not ask for money. What they were asking for was a false confession from the farm owners indicating that they were responsible for animal abuse on the farm.
A fundamental and quite simple exercise can be done to help keep cyber hackers out of your business. According to Ontario Federation of Agriculture's Kathy Lennon, cybercrime prevention on the farm is as simple as keeping your computer system programs updated.
Implementing some basic security practices at home on the farm. Do the updates. Oftentimes, companies put out the newer version of software when they identify that there is a weakness, and they are trying to patch it across the system. So take the updates. It's not that difficult.
Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
Experts say we are making progress in eliminating hunger and malnutrition in this country. Gary Crawford has more.
The year 1969. Two major events in that year. First, of course,
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The U.S. lands men on the moon, something many people thought was an impossible goal. The second big event that year, President Richard Nixon convening a White House conference on hunger and nutrition.
The moment is at hand to put an end to hunger in America itself for all time.
That feat, however, has proven to be more difficult than going to the moon. However, let's fast forward 53 years to September of 2022. President Biden hosts a White House conference on hunger, nutrition, and health, the first one since that one back in 1969. And he announces this goal.
End hunger in this country by the year 2030 and lower the toll that diet-related diseases takes on for too many Americans.
Then, in March last year, the president issued a challenge to public and private groups and businesses for committed actions toward that goal. And there has been a lot of action in this past year and just a few days ago at the White House.
We brought everyone back together to keep this strong momentum going.
Second Gentleman Douglas Imhoff told the conferees about 141 new projects that have been launched, projects worth about $1.7 billion, some of those projects focusing on feeding children at school. But Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern told the conference,
"It is not just about getting food into schools. It's about the type of food we get into schools. Nutrition has to be at the forefront. And sometimes that also means talking about kitchen equipment and refrigeration and making sure that the infrastructure is there."
In Washington, Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.